Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today John Taylor. He's got a book out called In the Pleasure Groove, Love, Death, and Duran Duran. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Vic. Thanks for having me.
John, this is quite a story. What made you decide to write it?
The death of my dad about coming up on 3 years ago caused me to sell the house that I grew up in, drove away from the old neighborhood, so to speak, never to return. That brought up a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions. I really wanted to memorialize my parents in some way. I didn't know that it was a book. I didn't know what it was, you know, whether it would be in music or I just didn't know, but I had these ideas about a memorial. And then at the other end of the scale, I got approached at the beginning of last year. There's been a bit of a gold rush for music memoirs, I think, in the, you know, following on from Keith Richards' memoir and the success of that. And I was approached by an agent in London who said, John, if you would be interested in writing a memoir, now's a really good time. And so I kind of put the two and two together and started thinking about a book, and began work on it last summer, and it fell into place quite quickly. I, for the most part, I really enjoyed the process of writing it.
Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards put out his memoir 2 years ago, and at the time, I think that there was some reluctance on the part of publishers to put out musician memoirs, musician biographies, and as you say, that just really opened the floodgates. That book was very successful, and now it seems like every time I turn around, there's another one.
Yeah, it's a fashion, you know. And but I think what gives mine a little bit of what is different about mine. It's talking about one of the periods that I focus on is this sort of like transition from the 70s into the 80s, and I think it's an often maligned sort of period. When I refer to the 80s, I'm actually talking about the first 5 years of the 80s. There's a particular character to that time where music and art and video and fashion became copacetic in a way that it had not been before. And I think it's an exciting time to write about and to reconsider. And I felt that it had not been written about, you know, It had not been, you know, there was nothing out there about that time. So I felt that was another reason. I felt there was a lot worth writing about, basically.
You're a little bit younger than I am. I was reading the book, and I got to the point where you're, I think, about 12 years old, and you discover Roxy Music, and that was just a transformative thing for you. And I felt exactly the same way at that exact same time. It was a revelation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was going on 13 at the time, and I think, you know, I identified with them in a way. I mean, yes, the music was, you know, very unusual and highly idiosyncratic, but they had this look that just like covered so many bases. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm glad you connected with that, because I'm not sure how many people out there in the States really, you know, got Roxy Music when they first came along, but they were this extraordinary combination of sort of 40s glamour, sort of 50s rock and roll kitsch with this sort of like future. I mean, they had this extraordinary image that I really, really connected with as a young man. And I was looking for looking for something to identify with, you know. There was a lot of that in the early 70s in the UK. I really liked Bowie as well. And, you know, there was just some fantastic, you know, music stars that had these really, really incredible images going for them. For me, image and style is—I don't know—I've always been attracted to that. Actually, that's always been important for me. I think it's become less important. You know, because authenticity is the buzzword. You know, and it's and somehow style or, you know, some kind of contrived image is not considered to be a good thing. But when I was a teenager, I was much more drawn to artists that had an interesting sort of presentation going on.
I'll never forget opening that gatefold sleeve and seeing that photo of Brian Eno holding the guitar and just that androgynous, bizarre. You couldn't look away.
Well, it had to. It's interesting that you pick up on that because it really it had to be a first. You know, it was an interesting time for the culture, and androgyny is a key word. You know, and I don't know why that spoke to me. I'm still working on that, but it did, and I related to that in a way that I didn't relate to the more macho, kind of more typical sort of male stereotypes. I always liked that transitional gender perspective.
John Taylor joins us. His memoir is In the Pleasure Groove, Love, Death, and Duran Duran. You grew up in Birmingham, and your parents really did you a big favor, didn't they? You weren't into school very much, and when it was time for you to go out and find a real job, they gave you a big break, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very, you know, I'd taken a foundation course in the arts. I'd done that for a year, and you know, essentially, the band started. I started the band that year, and I met a guy at college, and then, Nick was, a neighborhood friend of mine, and the three of us got together. We formed Duran Duran, and the first gig we did was at the art college. But I had to go through the motions of, I had to apply for a degree course, and I never forget the day in the summer where I got the turn down from all the degree courses that I'd applied to, but coincidentally, I'd been feeling that I wanted to make a go of music, and I never had any formal education. I mean, there was nothing that said, this guy's going to be able to have a successful career in music, other than sort of like a gut instinct and a growing passion. And I managed to turn that moment of, tremendous disappointment around and present that to my parents and say, listen, maybe this is a good thing, because really what I want to do is make a go of music, and I think I can get something going. And my father had just been laid off. He worked in the automobile industry in Birmingham, and he was sort of had an early retirement forced on him. Very, very difficult time for them. And they said, okay, we'll give you a year. And that was the greatest gift they ever gave me, and that was all I needed, because when you're 17 and hungry, you can get things going.
And it happened so fast. I think the word meteoric comes to mind. The last bass player I had on the program was Bill Wyman, and even the Rolling Stones didn't take off that fast. No. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, one of the differences between bands like the Stones and the Beatles was that, our first album was all our own material. I mean, the first thing, bands of the 60s sort of like started out, by covering, and then writing their own songs was an afterthought almost, but, my era, it was all about creating your own resume, creating a show that was, that was yours and that was entirely original. The last thing we would have done really would have been to fill our album up with cover versions. So that was, one of the differences. So by the time we actually got launched out onto the international stage, I mean, Simon joined the band, I think, in May of 80. And the first record was out less than a year later, and we were off on the ride. So we had to get to know each other in the public eye, as it were.
Another thing that struck me as unique was the fact that the five of you, once you got that core group together, you were equals.
Yeah.
That was very unusual, I thought.
Well, actually, not at that time, because I feel that the late 70s, certainly in Britain, the music scene was all about bands. The dynamic was all about punk rock. That was what was in the ascendancy in the late 70s, and it was bands like the Sex Pistols, it was the Clash, it was the Damned, the Buzzcocks, all these bands that were like, they were anti-star. They were ensembles, and it was the antithesis of the singer-songwriter, scene. And every band was a gang, and I think we got that sense of democracy from that scene. We wouldn't have dreamt of doing it any other way. And then the other fact that actually Simon, who the singer and also the lyricist and the great lyricist, was the last man to join. So it wasn't like we were formed around one writer, which is the way a lot of bands come into being. We're sort of formed from the outside in. But I think that is what has given us strength over the years. I think there have been times when maybe different members have thought maybe we should have done things differently, but I think it's been one of the strongest alloys that has kept us together.
John Taylor joins us. His book is In the Pleasure Groove, Love, Death, and Duran Duran. And with that meteoric rise, you also had excellent timing, because that's when music videos really took off and MTV was created, and this really drove things, didn't it?
That's one of what I call the X factors around our career, insofar as you just cannot predict something like that happening and the impact that it's going to have on your own career. None of us knew what videos were. We'd all studied diligently at the School of Popular Culture, and we all thought we knew how to have a hit, you know, how to tour the world, how to make it. But quite early on, actually, our first single was breaking in Australia. But nobody, you know, the management, it was too expensive to get us down to Australia. So it was recommended that we make this music video. I think we spent $15,000 on it. And we shot it in an afternoon in London. And when we watched it back a week later, we couldn't believe how extraordinary it was and what an amazing piece of art it was, you know. And the language of video was just getting written, really, in London at the beginning of the 80s. There was a lot of talent. It was a cottage industry growing up around it. And, you know, I think on our first trip to America, our managers met some guys over at Warner Amex who were talking about starting up a 24-hour music video TV channel.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have a lot of... They didn't have a lot of stuff to fill it with. I think that, you know, the music that was on the radio in America at that time, the rock music that was, you know, that was the staple of American radio. I think if there'd been videos for songs like Honky Tonk Women and Stairway to Heaven, maybe that's what they'd have played, and they would have gone down that, what is now called the classic rock direction. But they weren't. So they had to look to... They had to look to London and these cutting edge videos that were coming out of London, and that what that meant was that when MTV did come along and America actually got a 24-hour music video television network, it was playing cutting edge music and music that really wasn't getting played on the radio, which was really exciting.
I mentioned a number of people that I know that I was going to be interviewing you, and one woman in particular, she said, "Oh, when I was in seventh grade, he was my favorite. I had pictures of him all over my walls. We used to watch MTV, and we would just sit there and wait for the next Duran Duran video. We'd just wait until the next one came on." She just got so excited.
Yeah.
What was it like to be up there when you were at the apogee of the band's success, and you were on stage and you were playing, and you loved playing so much? What was that like with all those young women screaming?
Well, I think the apogee, as it would have been in the first act, the first go around, was quite a shaky. It was shaky ground, you know, and I'm not really sure if I was in control of the horse. I was on horseback, and it was tearing across the field at scary speed, and I'm not really sure if I had, you know, my feet in the stirrups, you know what I mean? I think that, you know, we had, after Live Aid, we had this tremendous slowdown, this cool down period. A couple of the guys left. They chose not to pick back up again. And when we did pick back up again, it was at a different tempo. And we'd stepped off the zeitgeist in a way. Uh-huh. But I think it's very hard to, or we found it very difficult to, I think we did the best that we could. We stuck it out, you know, as long as we could. It's quite a pressure when, you know, every song you're writing is supposed to be a number one record. You know, it's pretty tough.
There's a very profound confessional aspect to this memoir, because you had a lot of time on your hands and there were a lot of temptations, and you really went off into the deep end, didn't you?
I mean, the way that I describe it now is that it felt like I didn't have the off switch that everybody else had. And, you know, that's not to say we were all, you know, the rest of the guys were in bed by midnight. They weren't. But, I mean, it could be 5 o'clock in the morning. We could be in some club somewhere. And somebody would say, come on, lads, you know, we've got an early start tomorrow. We've got to, you know, we need to get to bed. And I'd just be getting going. And, you know, and that creates, you know, and when you're making those kinds of choices, like night after night after night, then you start building up this residue of shame. And you start feeling kind of stupid, you know, and you start asking yourself, what's wrong with me? You know, why didn't my parents teach me how to handle this? And, you know, I ended up in rehab, you know, almost 18 years ago. And the first thing that they taught me was that it wasn't my fault, that it wasn't a choice that I was making, that it was, you know, that it was in my, you know, that it was in my DNA. And that was, you know, and I wasn't, you know, and I had my system particularly wasn't going to metabolize, you know, the alcohol and the drugs in the same way as most people do. And that was such a tremendous relief. And that enabled me, that gave me a good foundation to start building, to start sort of, you know, building a sort of sober life. That was a tremendous relief to find out. And I think, you know, so that's, you know, that's part of what the book is about. Is laying all that out, how that can happen, you know, that we end up sometimes you know, under the influence, you know, out of control, and it's not a choice.
Well, I can just imagine the temptations, and I guess I wasn't surprised to hear that. You were on Top of the Pops so many times, and I'm sure you heard about the former host Jimmy.
Yeah.
And the temptations that he succumbed to.
Yeah. Yeah, which wasn't a complete surprise to me, because he was, you know, I mean, he was a freak, you know. I mean, that's how he got his popularity. But yeah, I mean, different kinds of temptations, without doubt.
There's also so much in this book about the process and how you wrote songs and what it was like, that collaborative process, and that key element, the last member you brought in, Simon, who has this poetic sense of writing lyrics. It's fascinating to read this.
Well, he's a true, you know, Simon is a poet. He's a true lyricist, you know, and he showed up. We were so lucky to find him. I mean, he was in Birmingham doing a drama course at the university there, and his flatmate was a gal that worked at the nightclub that we were all hanging out at, and she knew that we were looking for a singer, and she suggested to him that he come meet us. And I think out of all the guys that came and met us, we were auditioning at that time. We must have auditioned, you know, 40 singers over a sort of 3-month period, and I think he was the only one that turned up actually with an exercise book of lyric ideas. So, you know, as soon as we started playing something, because we had these instrumental tracks that we'd sort of been building, he was able to step up to the mic and start singing. And that was it, you know. And that's, you know, and it was just the perfect fit. He never went back to college. He didn't finish his fourth year, which is a, you know, speaking now as an adult who's got a couple of kids that have been through college, I know what a big deal that is, you know, when you don't finish complete your final year. But there was such a tremendous sense, a can-do sense within the band, and we already had an organization of sorts. I mean, we had managers, which is so crucial if you're gonna get out and, you know, make an impact. You know, for me, a manager is as important as a singer or a drummer.
We also discover, much like we did in Keith Richards' book, that Keith and Mick Jagger were childhood friends, and you and Nick Rhodes go way back. I grew up in Des Moines, and we used to see him around town, and everyone would go, "That's Nick Rhodes!"
Right, because he married a girl from Des Moines.
Right.
Yeah.
Small world.
Yeah, I mean, meeting, you know, making those connections, it's so important. And, you know, we were talking earlier about Roxy Music and how we related, you know, from a distance, how we identified with them. So when you meet somebody, or somebody's introduced to you. I mean, Nick was introduced to me. We had a mutual friend who said, "You guys are really going to get along," and and so we were like, "Oh, you love Roxy music. Oh, and you like wearing leopard print chiffon scarves or whatever it is." You know, I mean, like, it's so reassuring when you meet somebody like that. You know, and you can start hanging out together. And I mean, it would be some time before we'd actually get into the idea of maybe having our own band. We both started out as fans and just, you know, following other artists. And it wouldn't be until, you know, the Sex Pistols came along that said, well, you really don't have to. Sex Pistols and punk rock, it was like the abstract expressionist movement, you know. It was entirely against the idea of virtuosity. You know, it's like the less you know, the better you are suited to be a part of this musical movement. And we didn't know a lot.
The book is In the Pleasure Groove, Love, Death, and Duran Duran, written by John Taylor, the bassist and co-founder of the band. And the thing that impressed me about the book was that this book isn't about settling scores. If we read the Keith Richards book, Keith takes some shots at some people, and I don't see you doing that. I mean, I know that you had some tough times. You broke up with your management at one point. You had some guys leave the band, but you never talk about the reasons. You don't dwell on it.
Well, if I had any scores to settle, it was me saying I don't have any resentments, you know, and I actually believe in giving credit, you know, where it's due, and, you know, and I've tried to lay that out fairly in the book about how, you know, and how the story came about, because I also know that it's very easy to X people out along the way. You know, it's very easy to say, oh, well, they were never that important anyway. And I feel like while I'm still lucid enough to, like, remember and have opinion about what I remember, because, you know what, in 10 years' time, I may not remember. I may have a different idea about how it went. And, you know, I needed to get it down, needed to get it out.
As you noted earlier, one of the first places where the band really broke was in Australia, and they love you down there. It's like they love you in Japan. Even today, they go crazy in Japan, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, Japan's been you know, has suffered a lot, you know, since the earthquake, and I don't think we haven't been back there since then.
Uh-huh.
You know, it took a terrible, terrible hit. But in the 80s and the 90s, and when we did the reunion tour, Japan was the place that galvanized the reunion, which is a terrible cliche, really, as anybody that's seen Spinal Tap will know. I mean, Japan, I think, has the Japanese have such a enthusiasm for culture, and for Western culture in particular. I think anybody that's at any level in the music business has at some point been grateful to the Japanese audience for making them feel, having the interest, maybe when interests have cooled in other areas, you know, maybe when your home country's cooled. You know, the Japanese, you'll always find tremendous enthusiasm for your work there.
In the book, you talk about making a stop in Sydney, Australia. And you're staying in some really swanky place, and you use the Brian Ferry line. You describe it as penthouse perfection. Now, isn't that a line from In Every Dream Home,
A
Heartache?
Well spotted.
I love that song. What a demented.
I mean, I think that's one of my. That's the song I usually quote as my favorite lyric.
I love that song so much. I hear it in my head all the time. A whole long song, and then that crescendo at the end, but the song's about an inflatable doll.
You're right. Amazing, amazing.
Oh, my. And we have all these cameos throughout the book. You run into all these people. You're in the recording studio, and Mick Jagger's down the hall making a solo album, and you sit down with David Bowie. You hang around with all your idols. It's quite an adventure to read.
And it was an adventure to have.
No doubt. The book is In the Pleasure Groove, Love, Death, and Duran Duran. John Taylor wrote it. What's your life like now?
It's good. You know, it's good. I don't think I could have. I don't think I could have written the book, you know, if I hadn't have been if I hadn't have been in a good place. You know, I wouldn't have wanted to write it from any sense of pessimism or you know, I mean, the band's had a fantastic run. The last album, All You Need Is Now, you know, really connected, really clicked with the audience. We did a lot of touring. I mean, just this year, we've been to South America, Australasia. We've been, you know, we've been around the States. Sadly, you know, we had to cancel a show in Dayton a couple of months ago because Nick got sick. We had to cancel actually the last week of our of the world tour, which kind of meant we ended the project. You know, on a bit of a damp squib. But no, it's been a tremendous couple of years for work. And, you know, and the family's good, you know, everybody's kind of good. You know, we've got three kids that are all trying to transitioning into adulthood, and that's interesting to watch. And I'm getting behind this book right now for this month, and then I'm going to take a couple of months hiatus with everybody else, and then we're going to start writing another album in the spring.
How fun. And what do you consider home? What place in the world do you feel like you're at home?
Yeah, I'm quite divided, actually, because, you know, I met my wife in Los Angeles. You know, my kid went to school in Los Angeles. But once I started working with the band again, you know, I was traveling to England a lot, and my wife is a real Anglophile, and we decided to buy a house in the English countryside, which was a very different experience to what I was used to. I grew up in Birmingham. I lived and worked mostly in London. So to have that English, rural English experience has just been breathtaking. So I kind of, you know, they're both homes for me now, Los Angeles and England. So, you know, accepting the jet lag, it's a fabulous, I feel very fortunate to have that.
I love how you describe meeting your wife and how she was, like, not into the music scene at all, and she was calling Bruce Springsteen Bruce Springfield and Rick Springsteen, and that really tickled me.
Yeah. She hates me for that. She says, you made me look a real idiot.
That was hilarious. Well, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Vic.
Our guest has been John Taylor. That's John from Duran Duran. His memoir is In the Pleasure Groove, Love, Death, and Duran Duran. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. A dozen years ago, Martha Moody made her first visit to the Book Nook with her first novel, Best Friends. That book has gone on to sell almost 1 million copies. Martha still lives in Washington Township. She returns to the program next week with a very different kind of book. It's a futuristic fantasy set in the year 2047. America has been invaded. An army has come in from Canada, and they're in Cleveland. Maybe they're coming to Dayton. The book is Sharp and Dangerous Virtues. Martha Moody returns to the Book Nook next week. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.